Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Tax Resolution Institute's Practitioners Forum, part of our Tax Tuesday series. As a reminder, our Practitioner Forum happens every first Tuesday of the month, and our next call is going to be on December 5th, so please mark your calendars. Before we get started, as usual, I want to remind everyone how these calls typically work. If you can hear the sound of my voice, then that means that you've logged in correctly. Because it can be difficult to moderate all the participants we have on today, we asked for questions to be submitted via email, and a lot of you responded. After we answer those questions, and time permitting, we will open it up to the rest of you on the line. Also, as a reminder, members, VIP members, get priority on these calls, so you guys are moved up to the top of the list. Again, we will announce when the Q&A session has begun and ask that you please type in the question box your name as you entered it while logging onto the call and that you will have a question. We will then unmute you when we call upon you to ask your question. We will select participants in the order that you submitted your name in the question box. Once we unmute you, you will be prompted by a system that you have been unmuted, and you will now be able to speak for all of us to hear. As an alternative, you are also able to type in your question directly in the questions box if you're a little shy and don't want to come on the microphone. But and actually, I see some questions coming in now, so that's good. And that's it for the housekeeping items. Let's go ahead and introduce our speaker today. Joining us on the call is the head of our legal department at the Tax Resolution Institute, Mr. Norman Priceman. Norman is an expert on Chapter 7, 11, and 13, debtor and creditor representation, while specializing in the discharging of federal and state taxes. Norman received his BS at the Arizona State University and received his JD at Loyola Law School. Norman has represented both debtors and creditors, has a history of successful execution, and helps to identify and clarify legal issues for his clients. A seminar speaker on discharging taxes in bankruptcy, he has been admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. As the leader of the Tax Resolution Institute legal team, Norman is an invaluable resource both for his ability to communicate effectively with clients and his extensive experience working with the IRS and state taxing agencies. Ladies and gentlemen, Norman Priceman.
Good morning, everybody. This is the first Tax Tuesday of the month, which means it's the day that we answer your questions. So we have some questions to answer. If you think of something, you can always type it in, and we can answer your question on today's show. Every Tuesday is something different. Like I said, today is answering your questions, and we're here to help you in your tax resolution business, help you make more money, and help you get the results that your clients want.
Thank you, Norman. Yes, so now that we got that out of the way, let's go ahead and get started with the questions. Again, the VIP members take priority, so you folks are moved up to the top of the list. So those first few set of questions come directly from VIP members. Louise is asking, I have a client who shut down their LLC but owes 2 years, 15 and 16 of 941 taxes. We are working on an offering compromise as they may be a good candidate for one. I know the owners will be assessed a trust fund penalty. The one snag I know of may be that we have an alter ego issue as they reopened under another tax ID as an S corporation, and they are already delinquent on those payroll taxes too. So her question is, should I wait for the IRS to assess this penalty before sending an offer in compromise under their personal names, ask the IRS to assess the penalty so we can send the OIC under the personal names, send an OIC for the company that was shut down, or none of the above, something completely different?
Okay, so first of all, the trust fund recovery penalty is assessed against a responsible person, usually in a corporation. So for instance, if the business is a sole proprietorship, then there is no trust fund recovery penalty because the sole proprietor is responsible for the entire tax, not just the trust fund portion of the tax. Now, with an LLC, it doesn't say here, but it may be different if the LLC, for instance, is a single member LLC. And if the single member LLC elected not to be treated as a corporation, and if the single member LLC is dealt with in the taxpayer schedule C. So it may be, if it was a single member LLC and it was being treated as not as a corporation, that it's a disregarded entity, and therefore the responsible person test wouldn't be given and the trust fund recovery penalty wouldn't be assessed because the taxpayer would owe the entire tax. But let's just, for the sake of argument, assume that it is...
Yes, you just confirmed online it is a single member LLC.
Okay, so the reason that the trust fund penalty may not have been assessed yet is because it may not be assessed. It may be the taxpayer may be held responsible for the entire tax. Well, let's assume that, to answer your question, that the trust fund penalty is assessed. Well, first of all, you can't really submit an offer on a tax that hasn't been assessed yet, because if it hasn't been assessed, then the taxpayer doesn't owe it yet and can't submit an offer for taxes that aren't owed. So you would need to wait until the penalty was assessed before you submitted an offer. And remember, even though the company was operating with an EIN number, the trust fund penalty is assessed against the individual on their social security number. And on the power of attorney, you need to specify civil penalty. But what happens is there's a notice called notice of intent to assess trust fund recovery penalty. And then it gives you, I think, like 60 days, and you can either sign the notice and send it back, and then that means that you're agreeing that you owe the trust fund. And frankly, revenue officer told me she couldn't understand why anybody would sign that. Why just let it run its course? But I guess if you were in a hurry for some reason to have the trust fund assessed, you would sign the notice of proposed assessment. And that would be assessed, that would become final sooner. If you do nothing, then the assessment becomes final after 60 days, and then they would owe it. Or you could take that 60 days and you could appeal it. So it depends what you want to do with it. And the second thing is about asking the IRS to assess the penalty so we could send the OIC under their personal names. Again, I don't see why you would do that. They'll get around to it. They should have. If they are going to assess trust fund recovery penalty, then they would have done what's called a 4180 interview. That's the interview where they complete the form 4180 to determine who the responsible person or persons are. And that's what generates the notice of proposed assessment. So I don't know if there's been a 4180 interview or not, or whether it's even necessary. Send an OIC for the company that was shut down. I don't see why you would do that. If the company's shut down and it has no assets, I would imagine, and doesn't have a cash flow, so there's really nothing that they could do. So I wouldn't see the point of submitting an offer for a company that's shut down. What's more disturbing would be the possible successor liability of the S-Corp. So if it's operating the same kind of business, and sometimes they even do it out of the same place, same office or warehouse or whatever, or they have the same phone number, or the name is similar or something. So, I mean, there is a risk that the new S-Corp, even though it has a new tax ID number, EIN, it could still be treated as as an alter ego or a successor liability, and the new business would be liable for the payroll taxes of the old business.
All right, Louise, if you need any clarification, please reach out to us and we can use some of your consultation time to give you more specifics. But moving on to Juliet, who is also a VIP member. What are the next steps when a taxpayer defaults on an installment agreement plan and the IRS issues an intent to terminate your installment agreement notice? Assume that the taxpayer does not have the funds to pay the balance in full.
So an installment agreement can be reinstated. So what I would do is when you got the notice of intent to terminate, and also the reason that you get a notice of intent to terminate and it specifies on the notice could be a couple different things. One could be that the taxpayer missed a payment, and so it says a notice of intent to terminate because you didn't make your payment. Or it could be if they incurred additional tax liability. So if they filed their 2016 return and they owed on it and they incurred an additional tax liability, that would default the installment agreement. But the notice should say the reason that they're terminating it. And you can call and ask that the installment agreement be reinstated. And there's a small reinstatement fee. I don't remember exactly, somewhere around $50 reinstatement fee. And you can get it reinstated if they owe more tax or if they missed a payment or two. It may be reinstated for a higher monthly amount. But, I wouldn't just wait for collection. I would call and ask them what they needed to reinstate the installment agreement.
All right, Juliet. Moving on to Jeffrey. He has a question regarding statute of limitations. My client didn't file his 2010 tax return. IRS assessed the tax on June 2013 based on 1099s filed. He is self-employed. I filed his return in September of this year. Since the IRS didn't account for his business expenses, this reduces tax and penalties by over 50%. When does the statute of limitation on collection expire?
Right. So the 10-year statute on collection for the IRS is 10 years from the date of assessment. So I would need to see the account transcript because there was an assessment when the IRS prepared the SFR. And then when the taxpayer filed his own return, I would need to see if did they zero out the first assessment and then assess based on the filed return, or did the filed return just give him a credit and lower the assessment that was made at the time of the SFR? Because remember, every assessment has its own collection statute expiration date, or CSED. So there may be more than one statute running for 1 year, depending on if there are more than one assessment. So multiple assessments would have multiple statutes. But I would look at the transcript and see how they reconciled the filed return with the SFR and how they made those adjustments. And if they made those adjustments where they just lowered the assessment of the SFR, then I would say that the collection statute started at the date that the SFR was assessed. Because if the if the original return that's replacing the SFR was a credit, then there's really no collection statute because there's no tax assessed. So I look at the transcript and look how they did it, because they do it differently depending who's inputting it. They could input it differently. But if the new return generated a new assessment, then that assessment would have its own collection statute.
All right. Hopefully that helps you there, Jeffrey. Moving on to the next one is Michael. I'm going to summarize, Michael, your submission here just because you provided a lot of detail. But what it boils down to, Norman, is he wants to know the procedure for obtaining non-collectible status. He goes on to indicate that this is a single mother who had to pay college tuition for her two twin kids and withdrew money from a 401k, therefore generated a tax liability. She is unable to fulfill the liability and wants to be put in currently non-collectible. The issue here is Michael requested a 120-day delay for full payoff in the hopes that she would be able to get the ex-husband to pay their portion based on the divorce decree. That hasn't happened, and the 120 days is about to be expired. He wants to know what the process is or the procedure is to obtain CNC status now.
Okay, so one thing to remember is that although currently non-collectible sounds really great because it means that there's going to be no collection at all, it's not necessarily the best result. Sometimes a very low monthly installment agreement could be better. And the thing about low monthly payments is that the IRS will accept a payment as little as $25 a month if you qualify. So in some cases, $25 a month would be better for the taxpayer than being put in currently non-collectible. And I'll explain why. So first of all, if you wanted to stop collection, you really can't send a letter requesting to be put in currently non-collectible, or you could, but it really wouldn't be the best way of doing it because a request for an installment agreement made in good faith stops collection, where a request to be put into currently non-collectible status doesn't. So if they were going to review it, if you wrote that you wanted a currently non-collectible status request, they can continue to collect even while they're reviewing the request. But if you requested an installment agreement and you specify in your request how much you want to pay every month and which day of the month you want that payment due, then that's a pending request for installment agreement, and that stays collection. Also, if they deny currently non-collectible status, that's not appealable. But if you request an installment agreement and the installment agreement is rejected, that is appealable. So another thing is that you could appeal the rejection of the installment agreement, and you couldn't appeal the rejection of the currently non-collectible. But the way you do it is you're not really asking for currently non-collectible. You prepare a 433F. You should have a power of attorney, a 2848, and call ACS. And if the power of attorney is on record, then they'll look it up and start talking with you. If not, whoever you get on the ACS representative will give you their fax number, and it goes directly to their desktop, and you could fax them the POA, and then they can help you. And you don't send in the 433F. Normally what you do is the ACS representative will go over the 433F with you kind of line by line and ask you questions and fill it in. They may not need any documentation at all, especially if the expenses are within the standards. The only time they really ask for documentation is if you have an expense that exceeds the standard, then you have to prove that expense in order to get that expense in full rather than limited by the standard. So you call, you have a 433F in front of you, you have your power of attorney in front of you, and hopefully some kind of notice or something from the taxpayer. And after going through the 433F, they put it in their computer and they punch it out and they could tell you right there, and then whether or not the taxpayer qualifies for CNC or not, or whether or not they qualify for a low payment installment agreement. And sometimes they ask you, what are you proposing? So depending on the disposable income, you could propose a $25 or $50 a month payment. I usually request that the payment be due on the 28th of the month, because all payments have to be made within the 1st and the 28th. And so if you make it on the 28th, then that gives them the whole month to make the payment. Any earlier than that, and it limits them. So I usually shoot for the 28th of the month. And it usually takes them a while to set it up. So if you call today and set it up and said you wanted to be the 28th, it would probably start the 28th of December, or maybe even January. So that gives you time too, and maybe gives, in your case here, time for the husband to come up with some money. So usually you can do this all by the phone, and whatever they need, you can fax it to them. And you can get an answer while you're on the phone. But that's how I would do it.
All right, Michael, hopefully that blow-by-blow will help you with the process there. But again, you are a VIP member, so please feel free to give us a call if you need further details or further explanation. Moving on to Rebecca, also a VIP member. She's asking, I know that when you submit an offering compromise, the IRS stops collections. Does that also mean that if you file a return with the refund due, that the IRS will issue the refund to the taxpayer?
Sorry, no. A part of the agreement with an offer is that they keep that year's refund. So, no, they keep that refund. Because remember, an offer is based on your ability to pay. And so if you had this refund before you submitted the offer, then theoretically the money would be in your bank or something, and that would increase the amount of the offer. So if the refund is generated while the offer is pending, or even after the offer is accepted within that year, within that tax year, the IRS seizes that refund. So basically that refund is gone.
All right. Moving on to the next one. It looks like the last VIP member on our list is coming from Young. Here's a general question. IRS has made adjustments to the taxpayer tax returns, and the taxpayer owes money to the IRS. The taxpayer also will owe money to the FTB. Do you have a general guideline regarding how to coordinate handling of the tax resolution between federal and FTB? Do you finish IRS first and then handle the state, or do you handle both at the same time?
In terms of who to do, I wouldn't do it at the same time. And the reason is that whoever you're dealing with will accept an installment agreement from the other as lowering the taxpayer's disposable income. And so you want to be able to use that on one of them. If you were dealing both at the same time, you might not have a accepted installment agreement on either one that you could present to the other. Because what you need to present is something to show that there's an installment agreement. Also something that shows how much the balance is, and then that the payments are actually being made either directly from the bank statements or from canceled checks or something. Because what they'll do is they'll look at how much your monthly payment is and how much you owe to determine how long that installment agreement will be in place. So for instance, normally an IRS installment agreement will be for a longer time than an FTB. So where, like, for instance, an IRS streamline can be 72 months, FTB usually wants to be paid within 18 months, or sometimes you can stretch it out to 36 months if you do the financials, and in hardship cases, up to 60 months. So you want to show, so let's say you owe the FTB $10,000 and you have an installment agreement of $1,000 a month, that would mean that the FTB would be paid off within 10 months. So the IRS, when they're doing the installment agreement, would see that you have $1,000 that you can't use with the IRS for 10 months, but then after that, that money's freed up. So they would make the installment agreement kind of two-tier, where you would pay so much for the first 10 months, and then after that, your payment would increase by $1,000 a month. So you want to be able to establish how much you owe, how much the payment plan is for, and how long the payment plan is for. In terms of who would I do first, I would say who's ever being more aggressive in collecting. So, because you want to get collection. So if the FTB is levying and the IRS is being silent, then you want to deal with the FTB first. If the IRS is levying and the FTB is silent, then you want to deal with the IRS first. Now, there may be something where they proportion the payments. So like the IRS doesn't, if you go to the FTB first and they get all your disposable income, and then your argument to the IRS is, well, you know what, I don't have any money left over to pay you because the FTB is taking it all. Well, the IRS isn't going to go for that. And so what they want to do is they proportion the payment based on the ratio of how much you owe each and how much the monthly payment is. So if you owe the FTB $10,000 and you're paying them $1,000 a month, if you owe the IRS twice that, then the IRS wants to get twice that per month. So you really want to work it out so that you have one in place before you go to the other. And hopefully, I would say that the IRS accepts FTB payments a little bit more readily than FTB accepts IRS payments. So you might want to start with the FTB. But again, if the IRS is levying and the FTB isn't, then I would start with the IRS. And again, I wouldn't do it both at the same time. And remember that the IRS has different guidelines than the FTB in terms of standard expenses and also in terms of the length of their installment agreement.
All right, Norman, thank you very much. Young, hopefully that answers your question. Moving on to the next one. This is from Diana. Diana is asking, I have a client who received an IRS notice for the 2016 tax year, which included a failure to file penalty along with failure to pay and interest charges. I have no issue with the failure to pay or the interest, but I am questioning the failure to file penalty. Here are the particulars. Husband and wife going through a divorce. They were going to file married filing joint for 2016. We filed an extension to file as married filing jointly with his name on top and her married name on the bottom. Subsequent to that, he decided it was not in his best interest to file jointly, so he filed separately. Consequently, she also filed married filing separate, but since divorce has been finalized, it was filed with her maiden name, which was required after the divorce. Tax return was filed timely before the October extension date, and tax owed was paid in full with the filing. The failure to file penalty shows 5 months late, but everything I find indicates that the extension would extend the due date to October 16th, and she would be responsible for the interest and failure to pay penalty, which are minimal. Am I correct?
Okay, so when you submitted the request for extension, so maybe they only, since it was a joint request and it was based on the assumption they were going to be filing a joint return, it may not have showed up on her individual transcript. So you might just want to show them that the extension was properly filed under both their names and give her credit for having an extension as well. But I'm not sure if the divorce had been finalized, why did she file married filing separately as opposed to single if she was divorced, or head of household if she had children? I'm not sure if that was correct or not. But I would call and ask that that penalty be abated and show them some kind of proof that the extension was filed under both their names as a joint, but then they ended up filing separately. And if that doesn't work, then she may qualify for first-time penalty abatement program. And you can get both those penalties abated under the first-time program.
Yeah, in case it doesn't work out there, Diana, there's always an alternative to be able to help out the client. Okay, moving on to Gary. Gary is an EA, and he's asking, I have a client that missed the audit and now has assessed additional tax. It has been over a year since the audit was performed. What is the process to have the audit reopened to show the expenses?
Okay, so I'm assuming that the audit generated a 30-day letter, and that 30-day letter would have given the taxpayer 30 days to submit additional documents to the auditor so that they could revise their audit. I guess that didn't happen, and the next thing would have been the 90-day letter, which is the notice of deficiency, which with the changes, and it gives the taxpayer 90 days to file a petition in U.S. tax court if they disagree with the changes. So I'm assuming that the 30-day letter came and went, the 90-day letter came and went, so they no longer have the tax court no longer has jurisdiction to hear the case, so they can't file a petition. So I guess there's two things they could do. One would be to request an audit reconsideration with the original auditor saying that they discovered new documents. If the IRS won't do an audit reconsideration, then the next thing would be to submit an offer, doubt as to liability, and the offer would say that you don't owe as much as they say. An offer, doubt as to liability, you have to admit that you owe something. You can't say nothing. So you can say, you know, some of the expenses you don't have records for, but most of them you do, and if those records are accepted, the liability would go down, you know, 90% or something, and so your offer would be to pay 10%, and you would submit with the offer, you would submit all the documentation for expenses that you didn't submit at the audit. So that's an offer. Doubt as to liability. Mostly when we think of offers, we think of offers doubt as to collectability. It has to do with the taxpayer's ability to pay. But an offer doubt as to liability has to do with the taxpayer disagreeing with the amount that they say that they owe.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman. Moving on to Paula. Paul is asking, what is included in Trump's proposed tax package? Are the various credits such as EIC targeted? Paula, for that question, you know, nothing is law yet, so we don't want to give an opinion until we confirm what is actually going to happen. So we don't have an answer to that question. Unfortunately, we're just going to have to wait and see what happens and what Congress actually passes. So at this point, there's no point in speculating as to what could be unless we determine that it's already been law. Moving on to Jason. Jason is an attorney. He's asking, if the IRS issues a substitute for return and the taxpayer thereafter files a tax return, from what date the collection statute of limitation begins to run, the date of the SFR, the date of the taxpayer? I think, Norman, you answered this before, but go ahead and give it.
Right. So the answer is both. Mm-hmm. But it depends. Sometimes when you file the return in place of an SFR, that you owe more. You don't always owe less. And so, again, you'd have to look at the account transcript and see how they treated it. But generally, the answer would be both, that any assessment has its own collection statute. And so each assessment would have its own collection.
All right. Moving on to Gemma. Is it correct that if a taxpayer's 10-year statute expires in 1 year and they just entered into an installment payment agreement, that they will only end up making payments for the remaining year? If I understand this, it is a partial pay installment agreement?
Generally, that's correct, but there's a couple issues. One is the collection statute is told from the time that the taxpayer submits a request for an installment agreement until that installment agreement is either accepted or rejected plus 30 days. So if, and you have to look at the transcript, it will show installment agreement request pending and then installment agreement accepted or something, and you have to look at those two dates. And those two dates would toll the collection statute. I mean, sometimes it could be just a month or so, but sometimes it's a while if you're going back and forth or negotiating it, or they're asking for more documents or whatever. The other thing is sometimes they ask the taxpayer in order to enter into an installment agreement at that late date to sign a waiver. So you want to make sure that the taxpayer didn't sign a waiver waiving the statute on collection. But if the taxpayer didn't waive the statute and the installment agreement request didn't take a long time to be accepted, then yes, the installment agreement would end when the collection statute expires, and it would no longer be collectible. And any liens would be released.
All right, there you go. Norman, the next one is Eddie. Eddie's a CPA. He says, the question for the forum is the following. I'm a CPA and just getting started in tax resolution. How often do I need to obtain a COBEL letter, and what circumstances would they come into play?
Yeah, so not very often, and the circumstance would be if you had a client who was being investigated by the IRS for possible tax fraud or other tax crimes, and they hired, let's say, a criminal attorney or a tax attorney specializing in tax fraud, then what happens is they want to establish that attorney-client privilege but keep you in the loop. So normally CPAs or EAs don't have privilege with their clients, but attorneys do. So the way it would work is the attorney would hire the CPA to help them on the case. And so you would be working for the attorney, not the client. And the client could be billing, the attorney could be billing the client for your time too and the attorney paying you, or it could be part of the agreement that the client would pay you directly, but your client is the taxpayer's attorney, not the taxpayer. So, and again, that the purpose of that is to preserve the attorney-client privilege and still allow you to work on the case. That's what the COVA letter is, and that's the circumstance in which it's used, which you may or may not ever need.
All right. Thank you, Norman. And Eddie, just this is a great opportunity to bring this up. These are the type of things or information that you can save on research and have us, since we have the experience, to help you with. As an offer to everyone that's on the forum today, and some of you have already taken advantage of this, some of them are on this trial, but we're going to go ahead and offer you our two-month free trial of our VIP membership. And what that means is, as soon as you sign up, you get consultation time with any one of our CPAs or tax attorneys or professionals dealing in this area to help you resolve any questions, any issues, any cases. You need strategy, we can help you with that. You need to review forms, we can help you with that. Or you basically just don't know where to begin, we can help you with that. On top of the consultation time, which I think is a more valuable part, is you get ongoing training through our video on-demand library. You also get access to our e-learning courses. These are e-learning courses that you do online at your own pace, and everything from how to do an installment agreement and offering compromise to how to appeal a negative decision on an offering compromise, or how to represent a client in a tax audit. What are your appeal rights? All these different courses we make available through our VIP membership, unlimited access to them, and we're offering you the VIP membership for 2 months for free at no risk. I'm going to go ahead and push a link so that everyone that is interested, go ahead and sign up. And again, you do get all these additional benefits with the VIP membership. And some of you that are on the call now that I asked your questions earlier are on that trial. So thank you for taking advantage of what is available to you, and hopefully you find it very useful. So moving on to the remaining section here with the questions, I am running towards the end of the pre-submitted questions. So those of you who haven't done so yet, I'm going to be opening up the line for you folks that are online to go ahead and submit your questions. You can do it on the questions box, or just tell me that you want to ask the question live, and I will unmute your microphone. But let's get this party continuing so we can finish this up. Moving on, next one is Daniela. Daniela says she has a tax client that has been delinquent and paying taxes for over 5 years and owes approximately $120,000. He has now lost his job and is living off of unemployment. I want to submit an offering compromise, but client just informed me that there is an old retirement account valued at about $90,000. Will the IRS want him to liquidate? Client is 63 years old and will depend on that money when he retires.
Okay, so first of all, because the client lost his job and he's kind of between jobs right now, doesn't necessarily mean that that's a good time to submit an offer. In fact, it's probably not a good time to submit an offer, because the financials will be kind of skewered because it won't be showing any income unless he's collecting unemployment or something. So if his intention is to get a new job and continue working, then I would wait until he has his new job and the income is and expenses are more or less set before I would submit an offer. An offer isn't submitted just because a taxpayer is in between jobs and at a low point. They're looking at long-term collectability. And if he's, you know, it doesn't say what kind of job he has or how much he makes. But what if he's, you know, an actor or something, and he's just between movies or something, and the next movie is going to make $1 million. So the fact that he's between jobs doesn't necessarily make him a candidate for an offer. Now, as to the retirement account, I don't know the terms of it, but if he's not working, it probably has provision that he could use it, and especially at his age, 63. So if the taxpayer has access to it, then the IRS has access to it. What the IRS would want, though, necessarily, rather than liquidating it, again, because of his age, he would need it to retire soon, would be, can he borrow against it? What are the terms of the retirement account, and does it have a provision that he can borrow against it? Because if he can, sometimes you can borrow like a certain percentage, like 50% or something. So if he can borrow 50%, they're going to tell him to go ahead and do that and get the $45,000, and then he can pay back the rest on terms of the loan. So it may be better to see if that this may be a case where he might be better to be currently non-collectible while he's not working. And then when he is working, either submit an offer then, or maybe an installment agreement. But in either case, that retirement account is going to have to be dealt with. Hopefully just a loan against it would be the best.
All right. Hopefully that answers that question, Daniela. Moving on to Irma, when assigning the responsible persons to the trust fund recovery penalty, would the person who processes credit card charges for the company be liable?
I mean, probably not if that's all they did. But like if you look at the 4180, that's the Form 4180 for trust fund recovery penalty, it has a series of questions on what a particular person does. Do they have signatory rights to the company checking account? Do they sign returns? Do they review returns? Do they negotiate contracts? Do they hire or fire employees? I mean, there's a lot of questions. I don't think that one alone would do it, but it would depend on the answer to other questions. But there are some really horror stories about employees who had very tangential contact with this kind of thing, and they were held responsible. So I'd be very careful. But hopefully the 4180, they would interview first the principal. And if the principal says, I'm the only one who made decisions about who got paid, when they got paid, how much they got paid, I signed the checks, you know, then they may be off the hook. If they process credit card charges for the company, does that mean money coming into the company? So I think that would be okay. I think more important just who have the authority to determine money going out and to pay vendors or rent or electricity or payroll. Because the IRS's thing is, we should have been paid first, not last.
All right, Irma, hopefully that answered the question. Moving on to Wilson. Wilson is asking, under what circumstances would I be better off using the fast-track mediation during an audit?
I think generally speaking, the answer is, do you feel that the auditor is somebody that you can work with, or is the auditor being completely unreasonable and it's just a nightmare? If it's somebody that you think you can work with, then I would say try working with the auditor, because you still have appeal rights with the auditor, with their manager, with the appeals office, and ultimately with the tax court. But if it's somebody that you don't think you can even work with, and they're really completely unreasonable, then you might want to try something else like fast-track mediation.
All right. Moving on to Abby. I'm sorry, I skipped Henry. Henry is asking, I have a client that owes large balances to the IRS, FTB, and State Board of Equalization. Can you speak on the differences between the offer and compromise program for each agency? Is there one that I should file first or file them all at the same time?
So the IRS offer program is very different than the state. And the FTB and the State Board of Equalization, which is now something else, uses the same form. The one major difference is submitting an offer to the IRS stays collection while the offer is pending, but submitting an offer to the FTB or to the Board of Equalization does not stop collection, so they can collect while the offer's pending. And I just want to tell you that right now the Board of Equalization is at least a year from when you submit the offer to when you get some kind of response. So during that whole year, they could be subject to collection. So usually if I'm submitting an offer to the FTB or to the board or to the EDD, I want to submit a request for an installment agreement at the same time and get them into a small payment installment agreement to prevent levying their bank account or levying their wages. The other difference is the IRS offer, if you complete the 433A OIC, there's this kind of worksheet that you do at the end, and you plug in the numbers from different parts of the 433A, and it tells you what your offer should be based on those numbers. So the IRS is very clear on what the minimum offer is that they'll accept, and that worksheet is part of the offer. Where the FTB or the Board of Equalization or the EDD doesn't have any worksheet, they don't have standard expenses, and so you go through the offer, and then they ask you at the end, what are you offering? And the number, you know, where do you come up with that number? It's really just how much you think you can borrow or how much disposable income do you have times, I don't know what number, a year? So it's really different. And rather than having standardized expenses and a whole formula, the Franchise Tax Board and the Board of Equalization, the EDD, say that they look at each case on a case-by-case basis, which means nothing. So I would prepare the IRS first and see what that is. And if you do submit more than one, you might want to. I would think if you're going to submit more than one, you would submit them all at the same time. And you would proportion the offers as to the amount that you owe. So it would be a ratio. So if you owe the IRS twice as much, then their offer should be twice as much, like that, so that it's all proportionate, kind of like a pro rata distribution, like in a bankruptcy. If there's an asset case, then those assets are distributed pro rata among the unsecured creditors. So it'd be some formula similar to that. But it's very different process. And I think the major thing to remember is that submitting an offer to the FTB or the board will not stop collection. So you need to deal with that, where the IRS you don't.
All right. Moving on to Abby, who's online asking this question. She's asking, husband and wife are married in 2015. Husband has 2012 tax liabilities. How does the wife protect herself from IRS collections?
Okay, so even though the IRS is a federal agency and the tax is federal income tax, they go by state law to determine collection. And here in California, for instance, we're a community property state. And so the 100% of the community property is accessible to the IRS to pay either spouse's tax liabilities. So if the husband owes and the wife doesn't, and they live in California, the IRS could levy the wife's wages or bank account, even if it's a separate checking account that the husband has no signatory right to, in order to get the husband's taxes paid. The way around that would be, one is if you know a couple who are planning on getting married and one owes taxes, or that they both owe taxes, I would recommend a prenuptial agreement so that each spouse's income is separate property, so that the IRS couldn't levy the wages of the non-owing spouse, because that would be the non-owing spouse's separate property and not community property. If they've already married, then you might want to think of preparing a postnuptial agreement, or have an attorney prepare a postnuptial agreement. And the postnuptial agreement, again, would make the spouse's income, each one is separate income. And they would want that income would go into separate checking accounts that the other party didn't have access to. And they would very carefully keep their finances separate. They may have an agreement where one pays the electric and the other one pays the gas or telephone, or somehow, or they might have a household account where they each contribute a certain amount to a joint account that's a household account to pay household bills. And that would be subject to levy, but their separate accounts wouldn't be. So that's all assuming that they're living in California or some other community property state. If they're living in a non-community property state, then you have to look at the collection statutes of that state, because the IRS will follow state law to determine what's fair game and what isn't.
All right, we have a few more that submitted on here. I don't think we're going to get to all of them, but let's see if we can knock some of these out. Next one is from Joseph. I recently obtained a new client who has a tax liability of $106,000. The IRS has started levying his bank account. Since they have already started levying his account, is there anything that can be done to stop it now?
Yes. So what happens is that IRS is sending out notices for, you know, a year or maybe years, asking this taxpayer to pay their tax, and they've been ignoring it. So in order to get the taxpayer's attention, they levy the bank. Now remember, when they levy the bank, they have no idea what's in that bank account, how much or how little or if anything. And so once they submit that levy to the bank, it's a one-time thing. And whatever funds are available on the day that the levy hits the bank freezes. And after 15 or 20 days, it submits to the IRS. So if you get there soon enough, if the taxpayer lets you know that there's a bank levy soon enough, you can contact the IRS and either work on some payment plan, or if that money is needed for something like there's a notice that they're going to turn off the lights, you know, or disconnect the telephone or something. If the bill isn't paid by a certain date and the money in the bank account was there in order to pay that utility to avoid them turning it off, turning the lights off or whatever, then the IRS will release those funds to allow you to pay that, because they don't want you to be without electricity. If the bank has already submitted the funds to the IRS, it's pretty gone. But the IRS will send out another levy, but not necessarily right away. So you need to contact the IRS and work out some kind of payment plan so that they won't levy again. And as long as you have a payment plan in place and you're current, they won't levy.
All right, thank you, Norman. I apologize for those of you. I have Robert, Charles, Prince, Dinesh, Clifford, Markway, who submitted questions online, and we don't have a chance to get to you just yet. What I'm going to do is I'm going to submit your questions for next month's call, but if you need an answer before then, give us a call here. If you're not a member, sign up for the free trial, and we will address your questions, give you all the answers you need. Thank you very much for joining us this month at the TRIS Practitioners Forum, part of the Tax Tuesday series. Again, our next event or next forum is going to be Tuesday, December 5th. Thank you very much for all who participated, and we look forward to continuing to help you grow your practice, make more money, and find a resource to help you with all your resolution cases. Hope you guys have a great day. Talk to you again next month. Goodbye.